I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one, in the opening days of the Barack Obama presidency, is more of the rolling Brown University seminar on this pregnant moment from Camelot to Obamalot, impossibly great expectations and high anxiety all at once. We're asking Professor James Blight to channel John F. Kennedy for President Obama's benefit and ours. Jim Blight is a cognitive scientist turned oral historian and revisionist student of the Cold War, especially the Vietnam War, which Professor Blight thinks JFK would have avoided had he lived. Pundits love those links, Jim, between the two princely presidents, this skeptical literary turn of mind in both of them, and the menacing times in which they take power. For you, and you've studied it deeply, what are the real connections here, and which are the traps to avoid? And then we'll get to the lessons and maybe the counsel that JFK might offer BHO.
Okay, let's look first at 1961. 1961 turned out to be, for Kennedy, a year from hell. It was just one crisis after another. It was one really dangerous foreign policy crisis after another. And Obama takes office at a time when I think it's pretty clear that we are revisiting some of that danger. It involves nuclear weapons in Pakistan and in India and in Iran, possibly. Kennedy was very concerned about that. Obama is very concerned about that. It involves a moment of almost a sort of paradigm shift. Why do we care about this? This is an interesting. Now, it could be a game. We could think, oh, well, you know, how is Obama like Kennedy? Let me count the ways. We don't want to do that. I'm not interested in that. But what I am interested in is taking what we actually know about how Kennedy decided in these very dangerous crises that faced him in that first year or throughout his 1,036 days, how he actually kept the United States out of these disastrous wars or disastrous conflicts that could have evolved quickly or escalated quickly into nuclear conflicts. That's interesting because here we have another senator, a young, inexperienced senator who's got an Ivy League education, who's very smart, he's very literate, he's a writer. He's all of the things that a lot of us intellectuals like to see, especially against the background of a George W. Bush, who, even though he graduated from Yale, positioned himself as a good old boy from Texas.
But stick with the Kennedy-Obama connection or disconnection. Mm-hmm. They both have that kind of aloof anthropological eye. There's a detachment as well as a passion. Mm. Where do you get off the boat of connecting them and the way they work, their thinking, their ideology, their theology, their anything?
This quality of Kennedy's, this skepticism for buying into the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, however many explanations or recommendations, this is actually what saved Kennedy the first year. He had the good fortune to have a terrible, humiliating event that wasn't a national disaster. It was the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was completely humiliated. I mean, it was almost unbelievable. For many of your listeners have no memory of this, but I mean, these guys in these green outfits with beards had, in effect, whipped the United States of America 92 miles south of Key West, Florida. It's just inconceivable, but it happened, and he let it go forward. He didn't design it. It wasn't what it would have been if he hadn't been there. It would have been a little bigger probably, which means it would have been a bigger disaster. But he let it go forward. He learned a lot from that, and what he learned from it is don't believe what you're being told. Remember, the Bay of Pigs is called The Perfect Failure by Teddy Draper. Everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. It was absolutely unbelievable. So he changed a lot of things. He fired the top two people at CIA. He brought Maxwell Taylor in to begin the process of becoming the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He began replacing military people. He began replacing civilian people. And he began putting a lot more on Robert McNamara's shoulders as a guy who could face down these people when it really counted over in the Pentagon.
Jim, I'm thinking he learned the hard way not to trust Eisenhower's plans or even his own advisors. But would the case-hardened understanding of John F. Kennedy say to our new president 45 years later?
It's a great question, particularly because Obama has already stated that he wants to consult all the living former presidents far more frequently than anyone else ever has, and he wants to get them together as a group. If he were to add Kennedy to this group, I think what Kennedy would say, or I would say, I guess, as a scholar looking back, what I hope Kennedy would say is that war is always – all war is stupid. Now, Kennedy wrote this in the spring of 1943 from his PT boat. He hadn't yet been rammed by the Japanese destroyer that nearly took his life and took two of his men's lives and changed his life forever. But what he meant was not that all war is avoidable, that you're never going to have to declare war and try to fight it, but that you ought to look deeply into what you're actually deciding. What you're actually deciding is to send a lot of people to their graves, to send a lot of people miserably to their graves. And furthermore, I mean, this is really the essence of it for Kennedy. You have no idea what you're getting into. You have no idea how this could escalate beyond your control. You have no idea how politically unmanageable it's going to get for you and how quickly that's going to happen. The worst case, of course, is that nuclear weapons are used and millions or tens of millions of people die. But there's also the case of the Vietnam problem, which is the slow bleeding of America throughout the 1960s and 70s, resulting in almost 60,000 American deaths and maybe 2 or 3 million Vietnamese, and the permanent tarnishing of the American reputation and of the man who ordered that escalation, that Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, who wasn't skeptical of military advice, who was in fact intimidated by military people or anybody with experience in foreign affairs, of which he had none, zero, when he took office. He'd never been anywhere. He'd been outside the United States once, and he didn't own a passport. Now, this is the guy who succeeds John Kennedy, who grew up partly in Britain, who traveled widely in Europe, who was in a cosmopolitan sort of a person. But I think Kennedy, above all, if he had that 5 minutes that the briefer gets, if Kennedy would now be going on 92 years old,
yep.
He would be 92 in June. And if he could speak, what he ought to say to Barack Obama is, when somebody comes in and tells you you have no more options other than to send troops into a battle zone, other than to attack across international borders, or to move in that direction, don't believe it. Find another way out. Take your time. There's no need to decide right now. And it's that kind of pausing or lengthening the fuse that Kennedy was willing to do. Now, this has tremendous costs. It's not clear that Kennedy would have won the election in 1964. He probably would have, because the Republicans were going to put up a relatively weak candidate, Barry Goldwater. But he was a very hawkish candidate. If Kennedy had done what I think basically all scholars who study this now believe, which is not to escalate in Vietnam, which is very analogous to Obama's problem in Afghanistan. He inherits this.
Yes.
When Kennedy came to office, Vietnam was already a huge problem. He added a lot of advisors. But he had already begun the withdrawal by the fall of 1963. Now, Kennedy would have in 1964, if he continued that withdrawal, or in any case didn't escalate, which I don't think he would have done, he would have had a huge management challenge on the political side. Goldwater would have had a field day, accusing him of being a sort of a rollover wimp, that sort of thing. He had a real problem with that. On the other hand, Obama and Kennedy share something that we haven't seen in a very long time, which is the ability to educate the constituents. and an enjoyment in educating the constituents. Kennedy gave a speech on November 16, 1961 in Seattle on the 100th anniversary of the founding of the University of Washington. And it contains phrases like, "Once upon a time, we could charge up San Juan Hill and feel good about it. Now you charge up San Juan Hill, you better ask yourself what's going to happen when you get to the top of that hill. Who's going to do what? Is there a chance that you will regret what you've done?" He also says we are 6% of the population of the world. 6%. We're not even 6% anymore. We can't tell everybody what to do. It's just not like that. Kennedy is speaking in the early 1960s, and he's referring to this watershed that had taken place, the decolonization of the entire, quote-unquote, third world. Obama is coming to office now on the far end of the end of the Cold War, an adjustment that this country and in certain parts of the world have never really quite gotten their minds around. It's a different world. Everybody gets a say. Now, I think that Obama will take a lot of heat if he temporizes, if he doesn't send in the Marines, if he pulls people out of Afghanistan, if he talks to the Iranians, if he deals with Pakistan as a regional problem and not just as a place where nuclear weapons are parked. If he does all this, he's going to take a lot of heat. But we've already seen that in the Jeremiah Wright episode, he can take what looks like a disaster when it's coming at him and turn it around and make it a very educational, almost a learning experience for the American people. Kennedy did that on a daily basis. And one of the fascinating things about Kennedy that I find, because I have a brother who's a specialist in the American Civil War, every day of Kennedy's presidency was an anniversary of some Civil War event, a 100th anniversary, if you think about it. And he's constantly asking Ted Sorensen, his principal advisor, to go to the library and figure out how he can take something from the American Civil War, that horrible scene, 600,000 Americans were killed. How can I take that and use it for my purposes now, because I want to avoid that? There must be something in that for me. And Ted Sorensen trooped off to the library, or he sent somebody off to the library. And this sounds like something that Obama should know, that it's okay.
I've never thought of that before. Every day of Kennedy's term was a centennial of a Lincoln moment.
That's right. Exactly.
There are more troops on their way to Afghanistan as we speak. Many people are worried about Obama's war, the LBJ syndrome, me too. How real is the danger as you see it, James Blight?
The question is, I would say, when he looks at Afghanistan, which has defeated every invader and occupier since Alexander the Great, everybody has packed up and gone home, which, by the way, is also true of Vietnam. The Chinese, the Japanese, the French, the Americans all went home, and guess who's still there? It's the Vietnamese. It's a very similar problem of thinking that just because this country is defined as backward, as third world, as using weapons not nearly as sophisticated as ours, that they can be beaten if you just have the right strategy, is not true. Vietnam proved that. Ask the Russians about Afghanistan. They lost 100,000 men in Afghanistan, killed a million Afghans, but guess who's still there? The Afghans. Now, Obama has got to walk back from this. I believe that there's no possibility under any realistic scenario of anything like a victory in Afghanistan for the Americans. I think that he's going to have to get used to the idea that the Taliban is going to be in the drug trade. He's going to have to get used to the idea that this guy, Hamid Karzai, whatever he may be like or whatever his intentions, he is the reincarnation of Noden Ziem in Saigon. He can't leave Kabul. Ziem never left Saigon for the same reason. He wasn't welcome in other parts of the country. It was too dangerous. So he needs to look at this situation. He doesn't need to know much about Vietnam, but it wouldn't hurt to have a look back to see what happened to Lyndon Johnson here and what didn't happen to John F. Kennedy, because he called it off before he got in. But he's going to have to look at Afghanistan and really turn on that button that says, now I need to educate the American people about why it's wise for us to withdraw from Afghanistan. I don't know if he can do it, but I think that is the alternative to a quagmire in Afghanistan.
My last question is about things people don't say, people who know better. And I'm thinking specifically of McGeorge Bundy, the best of the best and brightest, the smartest, the coldest, the most closest to a human iceberg we've seen in that national security position. Unlike Robert McNamara, he did not suffer in public over what he'd done. He went to the Ford Foundation and then retirement and then to death. Well, it turns out he was in the most awful turmoil himself at the end of his life about what he had wrought. It's finally been told in a fashion. One of the most moving reviews of that book about McGeorge Bundy's last visions was reviewed by our colleague and friend Dick Holbrooke, who has just been designated as President Obama's man in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Dick Holbrooke has dwelt not only on the Balkan crisis, but on the moral lessons in the story of McGeorge Bundy. How can he apply that wisdom of surfacing those doubts, surfacing that pain, surfacing that loss, being very open and public about it before it's too late?
Dick Holbrooke has a tremendous background to take this job. He graduated from Brown in 1962 and went directly to Vietnam. He met Tony Lake in Vietnam, who had just graduated from Harvard, both of them young, brilliant, energetic, kind of over-the-top personal characters. Holbrooke later was Assistant Secretary for East Asian Affairs in the Carter administration with responsibility for normalizing relations with Vietnam in the 70s. If you can imagine, the war is over in 75. Carter says to him, Dick, I want normal relations with Hanoi, and I want it next year or the year after. Well, it didn't come till 1997. That's how long it took. Well, Holbrooke is much different than Bundy. Bundy's problem, I think, with regard, one of the problems with regard to Vietnam was that he couldn't imagine that there wasn't some point beyond which the Vietnamese would have all the punishment they could take. They would just be bombed to smithereens. They'd bomb them to the table. And whereas Johnson might have used that phrase, Bundy would have put it very differently. He was a math major, and so he would have talked about manipulating the incentives and the disincentives, and he'd spent a lot of time with Tom Schelling at Harvard, so he knew, the threat that leaves something to chance and so forth, and then they would come to the table. Holbrooke knows that's not true. He knows why it's not true, because the people were fighting for their country. They were fighting for the piece of territory that they were standing on, and they were going to be there. Somebody like them was going to be there after you packed up your bags and left. He knows that. Furthermore, Holbrooke, in spite of his, my understanding is that it's Dick Holbrooke, in spite of a personality that is very difficult to warm up to, is in his way a conciliator. He is in a way a guy who flourishes among hoodlums and crooks and mafiosi and drug pushers and so on. He did that in the Balkans. I mean, he says that every time he met with Milosevic, he thought he needed a shower. But I think Milosevic might have thought he needed one too, because Holbrooke is really a tough character, but he's tough in the service of conciliation and compromise and some kind of a solution. Bundy's problem in Vietnam is that the solution was to keep pounding them until they crawl to the table. And he never asked if there might not be such a point, or if the Americans would have paid such a price by that time that it's the Americans who would pull back. He just never got it. He didn't get it in the 60s, and he didn't understand, I don't think, he didn't have the furniture or the architecture to absorb the fact that the Vietnamese were going to fight to the last man, woman, and child, no matter what Mac Bundy said, and therefore, if you really understand that, you're not going to get involved in that way in the first place. McNamara got that. When he went to Vietnam, McNamara understood what he was being told, that the whole idea of bombing them to the table was total bullshit. It was never going to happen. And he heard enough details that made sense to him. Bundy wouldn't expose himself to those details. He wouldn't go and have those conversations. And consequently, he didn't have to face the music.
Part of the problem, Jim, is that Bundy sort of embodies the problem of people who either don't get it or when they do have such a problem being straight about it. But in the case of Dick Holbrooke going to Afghanistan, at least we have somebody who's pondered that tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what's he going to do about it? What would you tell him?
If I could just branch out a little here, one of the lessons, maybe the most important lesson or two lessons, let's reduce it to two, of all of this stuff that we now know about Kennedy, about Johnson, about Vietnam, about the missile crisis, about all that. There are two things, and Kennedy was aware, and Johnson, I think, was not. In relative terms, of course, I mean, Johnson understood some things, and Kennedy didn't understand everything. But Kennedy wanted to know, most of all, what is the story the other guy is telling himself? Where does he think he is? That's the secret to understanding the correspondence with Khrushchev during the missile crisis. What do he think his options are? Not do what? How can I manipulate those options? I want to know what he thinks he can do, because then I'll know that I'm dealing with reality and not fantasy here. That's just, Kennedy always wanted to know what the other guy thinks is going on. The second thing is, you got to talk to people. You got to find a way to meet them. Kennedy exposed himself to a huge amount of criticism for meeting Khrushchev in Vienna in June of 1961, and it wasn't a very big success. But they met, they sparred, they moved around, and they evolved a correspondence which probably saved at least Cuba and maybe the world in 1962. They wrote letters back and forth for the remainder of Kennedy's time in office. So you got to really ask, you got to be curious as to what the other side thinks they're doing. What do they think I'm doing? This is anthropology, really. It's this sort of like ethnography. What do I think, he thinks, I think, you think, blah, 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 blah. But you got to be curious. You can't do it mechanically. And then Kennedy took very seriously, I want on the ground, I want to know what everybody is thinking. I don't just want people coming in from Langley, from CIA headquarters, and giving me their damn charts. I hate those charts. I want a lot of other people. Kennedy was always sending journalists to Moscow, and he sent so many people to Cuba while he was in office. I mean, it's legendary. He sent athletes to Cuba. He sent he sent anchors to Cuba. He sent his college roommate to Cuba. I mean, he did all this stuff because he thought, you know, I got to get outside this box here. I got to get outside this bubble. I want to know what's going on. When Dick Goodwin, who one of his White House aides and speechwriters, told him that he met with Che Guevara down in Argentina at an international conference, he said, "You met with Che Guevara? You're a White House official and you met with Che Guevara?" He said, and Goodwin tells us in his memoirs, he said, "Yeah, I suppose I shouldn't have." He said, "Well, it depends on whether you brought any of the good cigars back or not. That's one thing. And secondly, what did he say?" Here's an American official who found a way. He knew Kennedy wouldn't. He knew what Kennedy wanted to know. A White House official is meeting with the most radical anti-American revolutionary probably on the face of the earth at that moment, and they're sharing a cigar and some rum down at Punta del Este at an economics conference. Now, the head of the American delegation was Douglas Dillon, who was the Secretary of Treasury, a rock-rib Republican from way back. And, of course, Goodwin never told Dillon that this meeting took place, so Kennedy had to tell him. But Kennedy, what he learned was, this is fascinating. He said, "Well, what did Che say?" Che said, "Tell your president that we are so grateful for the Bay of Pigs. We could not have consolidated this revolution without his assistance at the Bay of Pigs. It allowed us to throw 100,000 people in jail, and nobody even complained about it because there was an actual threat to our country, but not a big threat, just an actual threat." Now, see, that's very sarcastic. Kennedy understood. He understood what he was being told. "I screwed up. I should have never let it happen, and that's exactly the kind of thing I have to avoid in the future."
Would somebody please call President Obama? He'll take your call. Jim Blight, it's such a pleasure, and thank you.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.